Well, we've reached the halfway point in the book of Acts. We're at the end of chapter 14. And for that reason, and for other reasons too, it seems a good place at which to break away from Acts for a few weeks. So I intend to engage in a short series on a different topic. But I intend to begin that next Lord's Day morning. And this morning will be a one-off sermon. Back in April, in our monthly prayer meeting, in that context of just a short devotional time at the start of the meeting, I very briefly and insubstantially touched upon a topic that I would like us to revisit and to develop in a little bit greater length and detail this morning. How do angels fit into the earthly career of Jesus? Perhaps you think immediately of Jesus' birth, the angelic appearance to Mary at Nazareth, the angelic appearance to the shepherds in the vicinity of Bethlehem. Perhaps your mind jumps next to Jesus' resurrection, the angels stationed at Jesus' empty tomb, and announcing to the women, he is not here, he has risen. Perhaps your mind jumps next to Jesus' ascension and those angels there on the Mount of Olives, rebuking the disciples for staring too long into the sky as Jesus is lifted from them. Perhaps that's roughly the train of thought that my question sets in motion. Well, it's none of those three points in Jesus' career that I want us to consider this morning. It's rather Jesus' passion. And I want us to ask the question then, how do angels fit into that? What's the relationship between angels and the sufferings of Christ? And in that connection then, I want us to notice four things. First of all, angels required. Angels required. Where do the sufferings of Jesus Christ begin? Well, I guess that's debatable. But many of us would probably say, well, they begin in the Garden of Gethsemane. And that's an appropriate answer to the question. As Jesus leaves that upper room where the atmosphere has been so serene, and as he makes for that shadowy olive grove, you have the feeling as a reader that he's kind of crossing a threshold, that he's entering into the outskirts at least of his passion. Not that Jesus is flogged in Gethsemane. Not that Jesus is mocked in Gethsemane. Not that Jesus is crucified in Gethsemane. Rather, in Gethsemane, he grapples with the prospect of all those things. But such is his agitation, such is his inner turmoil, as he grapples with the prospect of those things, I think the very grappling with the prospect can itself properly be considered a part of Jesus' sufferings. And this agitation then, this inner turmoil, it's evident in various ways, isn't it? It's evident in his posture. Mark tells us that Jesus fell on the ground. It's reminiscent of David in 2 Samuel chapter 12. David's son is desperately ill. He's in intensive care. He's fighting for his life. David will later be heartbroken because of the death of another son, Absalom, a treacherous son who tried to tear the kingdom out of David's hands. But this son in 2 Samuel 12, he hasn't tried to tear the kingdom out of David's hand. He's a baby. He's a sweet, innocent, little baby. And David is in pieces, therefore. He's beside himself. And interestingly then, the narrator tells us he lay on the ground. That's how he expressed his inner turmoil as his little boy was slipping away from him. And Jesus then adopts the same posture here in the Garden of Gethsemane, because he's experiencing the same order of inner turmoil. Then again, it's evident in his speech, this prayer that he famously prays, "Father, remove this cup from me." And let's not be in any doubt here. Let's not beat around the bush here. Jesus is praying that the crucifixion won't happen. He's praying that he won't have to die on the cross. And yes, we know it's not an unqualified prayer. He immediately adds, "Nevertheless, not my will be done, but yours," and that has its own significance. But nonetheless, he prays that the cup might be removed. He's asking that he might not have to die on the cross. Now, that's a mind-boggling thing for Jesus to be praying there, isn't it? In eternity, he has covenanted himself with the Father to die on that cross at Calvary. He has undergone the seismic upheaval of the incarnation in order to die on that cross. Throughout the latter stages of his public ministry, he has repeatedly announced he is going to die on that cross. He has rebuked his disciples for failing to comprehend. He's going to die on that cross. And yet here he is now within a stone's throw of dying on the cross. And what's he doing? He's praying that he might not have to die on the cross. It's astonishing. And by the way, if it teaches us anything, surely it teaches us that there is no prayer that is off limits for us. There is nothing that we cannot ask God for. If Jesus could even ask God for the cross to be removed, even though it was the Father's command that he die on the cross from eternity, if Jesus could ask that the cup be removed, there is nothing that we cannot ask. We needn't be constrained by a crippling paranoia. It might not be God's will to give me this thing. It might not be God's will to give us this thing. It wasn't God's will to give Jesus what he was asking for there. But nonetheless, we have freedom to ask it. Then again, the inner turmoil is evident in Jesus' bodily functions. Luke tells us that he sweats, and that in itself is notable. It's not a warm evening. Just down the road, there are people in the high priest's courtyard who are warming themselves beside a fire. And yet Jesus doesn't need to warm himself beside a fire. He's sweating. But more than that, we're told that there was blood that was mixed with his sweats. Now, I'm no medical expert, but I do know that the soul and the body are perhaps much more interconnected than we often recognize and acknowledge, so that we can all get various physical symptoms like mouth ulcers and headaches and so on, the cause of which is stress and anxiety. And they're real physical symptoms. They respond to the appropriate medication. But nonetheless, their cause is stress or worry or fear or something like that. And surely that's what we have with Jesus here. Only this is a more extreme physical symptom, because he's experiencing a more extreme inner turmoil. And so it's not a headache, it's not a mouth ulcer. It's blood in his sweat. And so I'm saying then, his inner turmoil, it's evident in his posture, it's evident in his speech, it's evident in his bodily functions. But then it's also evident in this detail, which Luke alone tells us. There in verse 43, Jesus required angelic strengthening. Such was Jesus' agitation, he required an angel to come and minister to him. It's a very tantalizing little detail, isn't it, from Luke? We would love him to expand. How did the angel strengthen Jesus? We don't know. Presumably, it was with words. He spoke to Jesus. What did he say? What could he say? Don't worry, it's not going to be so bad. Well, of course, it was going to be so bad and worse. What did the angel say? Perhaps he simply pointed Jesus to the joy that the writer to the Hebrews talks about, the joy that was set before him. Perhaps he simply reminded Jesus of the reward that lay the far side of the suffering. Perhaps he simply pointed Jesus to that glorious future which this suffering was going to bring about for Jesus and for all his people. Perhaps he pointed Jesus to the enabling of the Spirit that he was going to experience on the cross, that again the writer to the Hebrews talks of, chapter 9 verse 14, by the eternal Spirit he offered himself without blemish to God. Perhaps the angel reminded Jesus, look, the Spirit will be enabling you. He'll give you the resources you need to get through. Or perhaps he simply, in more general terms, gave Jesus a sense of heaven's support for and interest in what Jesus was doing. Yes, Lord, here you are, and the inhabitants of planet Earth might be going about their normal business this night, utterly unaware that in their midst is the incarnate Son of God undertaking a mission of such momentous, eternal, cosmic significance. They might be unaware of this, but we inhabitants of heaven, Lord, we know what you're doing. And we're rooting for you. Perhaps he simply gave Jesus a sense of that. But whatever form precisely this angelic strengthening assumed, I just want us to appreciate how astonishing it is that here we have the eternal Son of God. He had created the angels. He had been worshipped by angels, and yet his determination to save you and me has now taken him into such new territory that he even requires the help of angels. That's an astonishing thing. I like going along to the supermarket at around the time in the evening when they're discounting all the fresh produce, and I often come home from the supermarket with stuff that none of us even likes just because it's got a really good discount on it. But if I were then to do that, to come away from Sainsbury's with my bags full of all these items, and if I were to kind of be going on about how wonderfully generous Sainsbury's are. I just love Sainsbury's, they're so generous, discounting all this stuff. If I were to talk like that, I would be a little naive, wouldn't I? I mean, here they are, they're this supermarket giant. They could discount half the store, the whole store, half all their stores in Britain, and it wouldn't really hurt them that much. Discounting a few loaves of bread isn't going to hurt them. And I guess we must be careful we don't apply that kind of logic to Jesus. He's the eternal Son of God. He can do anything, saving us from our sin and our hell. It's not going to hurt him. No, we need to realize that the gospel writers are impressing upon us it hurt him all right. It took him to the very limits of what he could endure and beyond the limits of what he could endure. So that here he is, and he hasn't even had a blow yet to his body. He hasn't even had a cry of mockery yet. He hasn't had a single nail penetrate his skin yet. But already he's needing an angel to come from heaven and strengthen him. It hurt Jesus to save us. It was a momentous ordeal and undertaking for the Son of God. Let's not think he sailed through it. Let's not think it was a walk in the park for the Son of God to rescue us. He could create a universe, he could save his people. He could create a universe like that, but he couldn't save his people like that. It took him to this kind of situation that we see him in Gethsemane. And as I say, that's only the start. So angels required. But then secondly this morning, angels relinquished. Angels relinquished. So he accepted then this strengthening of the angel there in the Garden of Gethsemane. But the Gospels indicate that he could have accepted an awful lot more than that. He could have accepted not merely angelic strengthening, he could have accepted a full-blown angelic rescue mission. That's what he himself says, isn't it? Just a few minutes later, as the mob arise from Jerusalem to get him. And you remember how the disciples react to that, and they reach for their weapons and they're flapping their swords around. And you remember how Jesus rebukes them, and we saw that in Luke's account. But in Matthew's account, this is what Jesus says. Matthew 26:53, "Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels?" Again, there in Hebrews, at the beginning of chapter 12, the writer has that little phrase, doesn't he? He endured the cross. Jesus endured the cross. Why is it so amazing that Jesus endured the cross? Well, we say it's amazing because the cross was so dire, it was so dreadful. It was so horrendous, it was so intolerable, it was so inexpressibly grim. That's why it's amazing he endured it, and that's all true, of course. But it's amazing he endured the cross for this reason too. He didn't have to endure the cross. His words there in Matthew 26:53 indicates that he had the option of pulling out. There were on standby 12 legions of angels. You know, a legion was a Roman military unit, roughly 6,000 soldiers. I know we don't need to press the details too literally, but 12 legions, if my maths is correct, that's 72,000. 72,000 angels, Jesus is saying, on standby. They'd make light work of that Jerusalem mob that had come to arrest him. They'd soon brush them out of the way. And presumably if Jesus had the option of calling upon them then at that moment when the mob turned up, he had the option of calling upon them at every other moment throughout his passion. In other words, Jesus didn't have to be arrested. He didn't have to be condemned. He didn't have to be flogged. He didn't have to be mocked. He didn't have to be crucified. You know how you go to IKEA and the first couple of times you go, you just kind of slavishly follow the arrows on the corridor in front, on the floor in front of you, and it takes you through all the bathrooms and all the bedrooms and all the kitchens and the toy department, and it takes hours to get through the place, and you just slavishly follow them, and you're exhausted by the end of it. But then after you've been a couple of times, you realize that there are all these little shortcuts, there are these little doors, and they don't shout about them because they want you to go all the way around, but there are these doors and you can pop through them and you're at the restaurant or wherever straight away. Well, Jesus didn't have to slavishly follow the arrows to the cross. He wasn't some kind of robot under external constraints. No, he could have popped through one of those doors at any moment. He could have called on the angels to come and get him out. At any point, he could have pressed the eject button. He could have pulled the emergency cord. He could have cried, "I'm the Son of God, get me out of here." But he didn't. As we sang, "From the track, he turned not back." He carried on, step after step after step. The angels there, ready, poised, and he carries on, step after step. They're one prayer away, one word, that's all he needs to utter, and they'll be down. And he carries on, step after step after step, to the cross of Calvary, and he dies, and the angels stay there in heaven. What a remarkable thing. We talk so much about heroism. We use the language of heroism all the time, the heroics of the All Blacks a few weeks ago, the greatest sporting team the world has ever seen, some said after that World Cup. the hero with the fictional heroics of James Bond that's been so much on people's minds in recent weeks. The heroics of Tim Peake going where no British person has been before. But all those heroics, they're so pathetic, aren't they? So puny compared to the heroics of Jesus Christ, this hero of ours, who so resolutely, so determinedly said, "Stay there, angels, don't come for me. Leave me here alone in this unfolding nightmare because I've got people to save and I'm going to do what it takes to save them. And I don't want you to come and get me out of here. I want you to stay where you are and let me carry on with this work of saving my people." What a hero Jesus Christ is. Angels required, angels relinquished. Thirdly, angels removed. Angels removed. Actually, that strengthening that Jesus experienced in Gethsemane, it wasn't the first time he'd experienced such angelic ministry. Mark tells us that right at the beginning of his public ministry, he experienced something similar. He was there in the desert, you remember, for 40 days and 40 nights in that face-to-face confrontation with Satan. And that took it out of him. And at the end of that period, Mark tells us angels, plural, came and ministered to him. So in the wilderness, at the start of his public ministry, there were angels to comfort and help him. In Gethsemane, there were angels to, or there was an angel to comfort and strengthen him. But surely if anywhere he needed angels to come and comfort and strengthen him, surely it was at Golgotha. It was there at the cross. We've perhaps sung in recent weeks those well-known words, "While shepherds watched their flocks by night, all seated on the ground, the angel of the Lord came down and glory shone around." That was what happened at Bethlehem. And boy, how Jesus could have done with a bit of angelic glory shining around at the cross and the darkness, the awful darkness of Calvary. He could have done with some angels then, couldn't he? But not a single angel materializes at Calvary. There's not a shred of angelic ministry goes on there. Why? Why does he receive angelic strengthening in the lesser extremes? But then at Calvary, where he needs it more than ever, why no angelic strengthening? Well, this is the answer. Because at Calvary, our guilt has been transferred to Jesus. And at Calvary, therefore, God is angry with Jesus on account of our guilt. To put it simply, Jesus is experiencing hell at Calvary. What is hell? Hell is the unsheathed anger of God. And that is what Jesus is experiencing on that cross. And you remember how Jesus had earlier told a story, again it's Luke that records it, a story about a man who ended up in hell. And you remember how that man languishing in hell, he's desperate for some relief. He wants somebody to come to him from heaven. He wants the man who had been seated at his gates all through his life, Lazarus, he wants him to come to him in hell and minister some relief at least to him. And you remember Abraham's response to that. He says, "Between us and you, a great chasm has been fixed, in order that those who would pass from here to you may not do so." And that's where Jesus is now, as he hangs on that cross of Calvary. He's experiencing hell, and nobody therefore can come to him and bring him any relief now. Abraham can't come. Lazarus can't come. Moses and Elijah can't come now like they'd come on the Mount of Transfiguration. And no angel can come. Gabriel can't come and minister to Jesus at Golgotha. Michael can't come and minister to Jesus at Golgotha. No, Jesus is now inhabiting a realm beyond the reach of angelic comforts. The angels don't minister to the reprobates. They don't minister to those whom God has banished to the outer darkness, and Jesus now has been banished to the outer darkness. I commented a few Sunday mornings ago in connection with Paul's sermon in Antioch in Pisidia on the land conquest in the Old Testament, Israel's conquest of Canaan, and I said that we often view that simply as God's grace to the Israelites, giving them that land, and of course it was that, but the Old Testament makes it very clear it wasn't just an act of grace, it was an act of judgment. It was God's judgment on the Canaanites, these wicked people whom God had allowed, of course, for 400 odd years to continue until their sins were ripe enough, as he put it to Abraham, ripe enough for judgment. These people who sacrificed their children in the flames, these people like Adonai Bezek, of whom you read in Judges 1, who got his enemies and cut off their thumbs and their big toes and then put them under his table to get the scraps that fell there. That was how he treated his enemies. Canaan was full of people like that. And so the conquest of Canaan, it wasn't just God's grace to Israel, it was God's judgment upon Canaan. And the Canaanites then were under God's curse. And that's why the instructions to Israel as they go into the land are so specific. They weren't to apply the terms of the Geneva Convention. They weren't to treat their prisoners of war humanely. No, in Moses' words in Deuteronomy 7 verse 2, they were to show no mercy to Jericho and Ai and all these other Canaanite cities. They were to show no mercy because these people were under God's curse and therefore they couldn't be shown any mercy. And here's Jesus now at Calvary and he's under God's curse. And he can't be shown any mercy. There's no angel in heaven that would dare defy God's curse now and come and minister to Jesus. And there's no angel that will move a muscle to come and bring him relief now because he's been cursed by God. He's beyond the reach of any angel. Oh, make me understand it, we sing, don't we? Help me to take it in, what it meant to you, the Holy One, to take away my sin. We can never fully understand it. Here he is, this one whom angels worship, but now he's been so comprehensively banished by God that no angel will even touch him with a barge pole. Angels removed. But then fourthly and finally this morning, angels released. Angels released. Why is Jesus suffering there on that cross of Calvary? Yes, as I said just now, he's bearing our guilt. But of course, the story is a fuller one than that. Jesus is there suffering on that cross of Calvary because from eternity, God the Father has chosen a people and has designed to pour out upon that people a whole package of benefits. But in order for that package of benefits to be released, death has to occur. You remember how, again, the writer to the Hebrews in Hebrews 9 likens the whole arrangement to a will, and the way in which in a will there are a whole load of benefits that are promised, but in order for those benefits to be released, someone has to die. There has to be a death for the benefits of a will to be released. And the writer to the Hebrews says that's how it works with the death of Jesus Christ. So what benefits then were released through the death of Jesus Christ? Well, we could spend all day enumerating those, couldn't we? The benefit of justification. The fact that we then have this right standing in the court of the judge of all the earth. The God who judges all men, he says, you are in the right, you are justified. What a benefit that is. The benefit of adoption, that God has even brought us into his very family so that we are the children of God. We are princes and princesses in his very family. What a benefit. The benefit of community, being in the church of Jesus Christ, being living stones in this building that he is constructing. What a benefit. Again, the benefit of eternal glory, that great future that is lined up for every believer in Jesus. The benefit, I guess, supremely of fellowship with the triune God, communion with Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, day in, day out, throughout life, and then again throughout eternity. And so we could go on then, but there's another benefit that perhaps we don't think about all that often. You remember how Jacob had to leave home so suddenly. His brother wanted to kill him. And so there he is, and he's fleeing his home, his family, everything he's known. He's a home bird, it seems. And it's a very stressful situation then for him to have to leave, and especially to have to leave in those circumstances. And he's no doubt anxious, and he's worried, and he's very concerned. And there he is, spending his first night away from home. And you remember how in that connection God gives him that dream. And what does he see? Well, he sees all these angels ascending and descending on a ladder. And the point is then that God is with Jacob, and God is committed to helping Jacob as he goes off on this new and scary chapter of his life. God is committed to helping Jacob and even helping him through angels. And that is borne out much later on when Jacob is at another very scary point. He's now on his way back after 20 years away, and he's going back home, and he doesn't know what frame of mind Esau is going to be in when he re-encounters him. And you remember how at the beginning of Genesis 32, we're told, again, very tantalizingly, very mysteriously, we're told that the angels met Jacob, so that he called the place Mahanaim. Mahanaim meaning two camps. Jacob was saying, well, there's my camp, me and my wives and my children and my stuff. There's my camp, but there's also this other camp that's with me and alongside me, protecting me, an angelic camp, a heavenly camp. And that then was bearing out that vision that he'd seen all those years earlier. God was with him and helping him even through angels. And of course, it's very easy for us to read passages like that and to think, well, that was back then, that was Jacob, that was these greats of the Bible who experienced angelic help. But we shouldn't think like that, should we? Hebrews 1:14 tells us that angels are all ministering spirits sent to serve those who will inherit salvation. That's us. Indeed, the book of Hebrews is bracketed, isn't it, by such references. You have that reference at the end of chapter 1, and then at the beginning of chapter 13, you have that mysterious reference to people entertaining angels without knowing it, as the writer encourages hospitality amongst the people to whom he's writing. And of course, the Hebrew believers to whom that letter is addressed, they're where we are. The whole reason the letter has to be written to them is because they were finding their Christian life so ordinary, so banal, so mundane. They're not experiencing miracles happening around them all the time. This isn't the Exodus. This isn't the time of Elijah and Elisha. This is the time when people just go out to work in the morning and do their job and come back at night. That was Christian existence for the Hebrews. And yet the writer says, look, there are angels who are ministering to you and helping you. And I'm asking, on what basis do we experience this angelic ministry? What is the ladder that Jacob saw? Well, it's not, at the end of the day, a literal ladder, is it? Do you remember how Jesus interprets it? At the end of John chapter 1, verse 51, talking to Nathanael, he says, truly, truly, I say to you, you will see heaven opened. And then, clearly alluding to Jacob and his dream, and the angels of God ascending and descending on a ladder? No, on the Son of Man. On me, he's saying. through my mission, through my death that I'm going to accomplish. I'm the basis on which angels minister to believers. And I'm saying then this is a final relationship between the sufferings of Christ and angels, but it's the sufferings of Christ that release this angelic ministry for us. What is that angelic ministry? Well, I can't really say all that much about that because the New Testament doesn't give us many details. In doing so, it doesn't invite us to be obsessed with angels and to overplay this whole subject. And of course, God helps us in all kinds of ways, of which angels are only one kind. But nonetheless, it's clear from Hebrews 1:14 and other verses that we, as New Testament believers, are helped by angels. Perhaps in ways that we haven't been aware of at all. Over this past week, we've been helped by God through angels. And I'm saying that's because Jesus died on the cross. Like all the other benefits we enjoy as believers, that one too has been released for us through Jesus dying. And so let's be amazed at this Saviour and all that he underwent for us, that he went to such lengths that he required angelic strengthening, that he relinquished the possibility of an angelic rescue mission, that at Golgotha he was in a place where no angel could touch him, and that he, through his death, has released for us an angelic ministry, which we're not often aware of, I'm sure, but which nonetheless we do benefit from. And let's worship then this Saviour until finally we join with the angels in heaven in worshipping him in a better way. Amen.